It's 5 o'clock. It is Monday, the 29th of March, 2021. How are you? I bet you're warm if you're in the UK. Lovely afternoon, lovely morning, lovely day. So it is. Nice spring day. Temperatures around 20, 22 degrees down south, about 15, 16 here in the northwest. It's lovely, so it is. Hope you've had a great weekend. Welcome to the first Richie Allen Show of the week. Lots to talk about. Let's do it then.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, Dr. Tess Laurie is a medical doctor and researcher. She's based in Bath, so she is a lovely part of the world, by the way. And Tess runs the evidence-based medicine consultancy, EBMC. And she's coming on to talk about ivermectin and why she's involved in a very big fundraiser to get ivermectin approved for treating coronavirus or COVID-19. This is going to be very interesting. Dr. Tess Laurie in the second hour. And before that, Brian Sylvester returns to the programme. Brian served the people of Crewe for nearly five decades, two terms as a councillor for Cheshire East. He's going to be running again in May. Not far from me, really. He'll be back on the programme this hour. Lots to talk about with Brian Sylvester. So it should be a good programme. And as usual, if you'd like to join in and give me or tell me your opinion, do it via Twitter. It's at BBG Richie there. How about that? All right. Yes, it's been glorious. Not that I've seen very much of it, because I've been working. Don't you know? Of course I've been working. I've been here beavering away. Before I go any further, quick email from Paul this morning. He says, Richie, would you please cover a sinister story emerging from Ireland? First to third year student nurses can only go on placement this week if they have had a vaccine. Literally a no jab, no placement policy from the HSE, which is Ireland's Health Service Executive. Okay, that's the Irish version, or Ireland's version, yeah, you could say that, of the NHS here. Paul says, I'm a nurse myself and I have been speaking to student nurses and they would like this to be exposed. Now, I've seen some talk of this on Twitter this afternoon as well. And I don't doubt this is the case, but I haven't been able to confirm it officially. Like I said, I don't doubt it is the case. Unsurprising. But I've not been able to get anybody to come on and talk to me today about it, sadly. If you're a student nurse in Ireland and you happen to be listening to this and you do want to talk about it, I'll make room for you anytime you want this week. Get in touch with me via Twitter or drop a mail through the contact thingy on the website richieallen.co.uk. So thanks to Paul. First to third year student nurses allegedly told no placement in hospitals or in facilities if you haven't had a vaccine. Shocking, but unsurprising. You probably saw, if you do stay in touch with richieallen.co.uk, the announcement overnight that Brisbane will go back into a snap lockdown. This is, of course, the city of Brisbane in Australia. And this was announced last night. It comes into effect at 6 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday morning, in Brisbane. Staggering stuff, this. They discovered three or four cases of coronavirus on Saturday and another three or maybe four on Sunday, or it would have had to be Sunday or even Monday morning, because of course they're a good 10 hours or so ahead of us here. Anyway, based on these seven cases, they've decided to go into lockdown. Anastasia Palaszczuk is the Premier of Queensland and said, I know it's really tough. We have Easter coming up. We have school holidays, but let's do it now and let's do it right. And let's see if we can come through it at the other end. Come through it. Seven people. And as far as I understand, seven healthy people tested positive for a virus after taking a PCR test. And a city of 2 million people is shut down. Mad stuff, this. Mad stuff. What else have I got to tell you? And the concert in Barcelona. I wrote about this morning as well. I came across this over the weekend because a number of European news agencies covered this. 5,000 fans wore masks at a concert in Barcelona on Saturday night. Would you believe? And as part of a trial, now the concert was allowed to go ahead so long as the promoters provided the concert goers with face masks, right? But the city also took advantage of the concert and got everybody to agree to taking a same day COVID antigen test as part of an experiment to see if this could be done on a larger scale. And these 5,000 fans did. They went to three different locations in the city of Barcelona, took a test. The great, great majority passed the test. They came to the concert and they all wore masks. Photographs of it on richieallen.co.uk. Is this the new normal? Might very well be. It might very well be. By the way, the name of the band, the 5,000, were watching, a band I've never heard of called Love of Lesbian. Who the feck are Love of Lesbian? I have no idea. Anyway, two households or groups of up to six people can now meet outside in England as the COVID restrictions are loosened somewhat. And according to the BBC this afternoon, people have been going to outdoor sports facilities today, including tennis courts and golf courses. Weddings can take place again, but only with six people in attendance. The Prime Minister has urged caution. He says cases are up in Europe and variants are threatening the rollout of the vaccine and all of that. Here's his sports minister, Nigel Huddleston, on BBC Breakfast this morning, warning about hugs.
Despite the temptation, please don't risk the health of your loved one by actually hugging them and risk the spread of the disease. And of course, when you're hugging somebody, you're in incredibly close proximity to them. So please, again, just be sensible. Everybody does know the rules. I think actually we've been through this. Most people do know the rules. We know what to do. We know how to behave. And also, if you see somebody behaving in a slightly odd way, then maybe call them out on it in a respectful way, because sometimes some people just forget.
Really? What would you say? How would you handle that?
Good question.
Well, if you see a loved one, say, look, let's just be a little bit more careful here. Sorry, love to give you a hug, but not at the moment. I think people are sensible about this. Actually, you do see people acting a little bit with caution. You see people all the time kind of getting close to each other and then suddenly thinking, oh, you know what, I can't do that. Let's just keep the distance. I know it's a little bit awkward, but actually in these circumstances, it's the right thing to do.
The right thing to do. Somebody comes towards you, put your hands up and say, sorry, look, I'd love a hug. I'd love a hug now. Could really use one. But not at the moment, all right? No hugs permitted at the moment. I was listening to BBC Radio 5 Live's breakfast programme earlier, and a BBC radio presenter, I think Rick Edwards, the guy's name, said that he'd be seeing his mum and dad this afternoon. But no hugs, he said. Why? Because hugs are not permitted at the moment. Hugs. I'm going to leave that one there. It's coming up for 8 minutes past the hour at BBG Richie. People living with those who have weakened immune systems should be able to get their COVID-19 vaccine, according to the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation. Right? If you live with someone and they are immunocompromised, meaning that they're wide open to bugs and whatnot and getting sick, you can get the jab for both of you. And it should be prioritised, says the JCVI. People who are over 16 and living with immunosuppressed adults should be prioritised for the vaccine. Who has got a weakened immune system? Well, people undergoing chemotherapy, unsurprisingly, and other immunosuppressive treatment, those who have HIV and people with leukemia. Yes. The move should help to limit the spread to immunosuppressed adults who are less able to fight infections naturally, says the JCVI professor, Wei Shen Lim. He chairs the JCVI. He says the vaccine is doing well. It's having an effect on hospitalizations and deaths. It's bringing deaths down, but it isn't as effective in people who are immunosuppressed. Now, this was interesting this morning. Julia Hartley Brewer, presenter for Talk Radio, had Jeremy Brown on. Now, he's a member of the JCVI, the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation. Okay, she had Jeremy Brown on. Julia is upset that she's being kept in lockdown by people who can't or won't have the vaccine. The people who can't are immunosuppressed people. The people who won't have it, people like me, possibly people like you. So she's fed up. She wants out. She's had her jab. Here she is again with Jeremy Brown, JCVI.
And also, of course, there are people who've, who are not able to get the vaccine for health reasons and exemptions. And obviously those people, and again, as much as I have sympathy for those people or people who, for instance, are cancer patients and it's not been as efficacious on them, I have every sympathy in the world and let's do whatever we can to keep you safe. But I'm not entirely sure whether that justifies the rest of the country being locked down. And the people who choose not to get vaccinated, I've got to be honest with you, I couldn't care less about them. I care not one jot about them. If they choose not to get the vaccination, I absolutely endorse their right to do that. But why the rest of the country should have to be in lockdown because they choose not to get a vaccine that could protect them, that's entirely their choice. But it's not my problem.
That's where I differ. I do care about them. And I'd like them
why?
To be vaccinated.
I want them to be educated. I want I campaign, cajole, persuade, educate. Fine.
Yeah.
But don't keep me locked up in my home because they won't take a vaccine.
She's very shrill, isn't she, JHB, Julia Hartley Brewer? Don't keep me locked up, goddammit, because some people can't or because they won't have their vaccine. I've had mine. I want to go out. I want to be free. I want to be free to do what I want to do. I want to get loaded. She wants to get pissed out of her brains, Julia Hartley Brewer. Who can blame her? But this guy doesn't agree, this JCVI guy.
Okay, so let's talk about this in a less black and white fashion, all right? Because your position and my position, they're not two ends of the spectrum. They are sort of two ends of the spectrum, but it's not black and white. It's a grey situation. What I'm thinking, that what I consider what should happen is that there's a modulation of the social distancing as the vaccine progresses. If you were to release, which I think is your position at the moment, Julia, at this point in time, that is a mistake and that would lead to a lot of death and illness at this point in time. Now, as we go forward over the next few weeks, things would loosen up and should be a lot stronger position. And I take your point about if people have been offered the vaccine, then that's their responsibility. But I think it's much more complex than that. People are scared of the vaccine. They need to be reassured that it isn't dangerous. They need to fully understand the reason why the vaccine is a problem. And we spend a lot of time trying to do that. But it takes time to persuade people to have vaccines sometimes.
Well, again, we're going to have to agree to differ on this one. I have to say, I don't know why millions of people are in lockdown because people are too scared to leave their homes. They're hiding behind the back of the sofa. And then we're having to be in lockdown because people are too scared to go and get the vaccine that apparently is the route out. I don't know what the answer is other than that. I just don't think we should be responsible constantly for other people's health in a way if they're not prepared to take responsibility for themselves. But I'm old-fashioned. I believe in individual responsibility rather than the state telling us everything what to do. But
well, rather than the state and the big arms and the long legs of the state telling us what to do, says Julia Hartley Brewer. Faisal tweets, Richie, if this vaccine doesn't protect the immune-suppressed, what's the point of it, says Faisal. Well, Faisal, I think you are clever enough to know, my friend, to know their argument. Their argument is, if the rest of us have the vaccine, it'll get rid of coronavirus. I know it's nonsense, you know it's nonsense, but that is their argument. That if you all have it, it'll limit the chances of the immunosuppressed person getting it. Be a good citizen, have the vaccine. You might be young and healthy and very unlikely to catch COVID, certainly. Certainly very unlikely to catch it and almost certainly will never get sick from it. But have the vaccine anyway. Go on. Why? Because there are some people that are vulnerable out there and they can't have it. So why don't you have it on their behalf? No, thank you, is what I would say. And I've had a tweet from Angela. Surprising tweet. Let me read it out there. Not surprising that it's come from Angela, but surprising in its content. Richie, I hugged an elderly man twice today on the occasion of his wife's funeral. He sang the hymns at the church through his mask, even though we were told not to sing. I hummed along with him, says Angela. It's just evil in the extreme. Gentleman is burying his wife and he wants to sing. It reminds me of my grandfather, who was a fantastic singer, a tenor of much renown in my hometown. And when my grandmother died back in 2002, I remember him singing at the altar, singing I can't remember exactly what he sang now, but yeah, it takes me right back. And this elderly gentleman singing through a mask because he was told he had to wear a mask at the church. These are mad times. They are mad times, you know. Mad times when you have government ministers going on television telling people not to hug each other. Yeah. Just keep moving, Richie. Don't dwell on that, because it's too early now in the week to be getting upset about things like that. Julia Hartley Brewer, you heard there a minute ago. David Lammy is the Shadow Justice Secretary. I'll remind you for the last time and the 500 millionth time that every government Secretary of State has a shadow, has an opposite number in the main opposition party. The Justice Secretary in the UK, as far as I know, it's Buckland, isn't it? Is that the guy's name? And David Lammy is the shadow. He's also got a programme on LBC Radio every Saturday afternoon. I won't get into the wrongs of politicians having their own radio programmes. I've done it to death. It's shocking and it sickens me, but I won't talk about it. Anyway, he was on LBC this morning, David Lammy, sitting in, I think, for James O'Brien. I could be wrong. Maybe it was Fogarty. Anyhow, earlier, very early in the morning, before he went to work, Lammy and the Conservative Party MP Sajid Javid, the former Chancellor, that's right, Chancellor, yes. Lammy and Javid were two people of colour featured on shows today speaking about getting rid of the term BAME. Okay, BAME stands for Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic. Lammy said it's terrible, it's outdated, it's prejudicial, blah, blah, blah. Sajid Javid said something similar. Anyhow, right. So he's on LBC as the presenter today, the Shadow Justice Secretary, and he got a call from Jean. He got a call from Jean, and it had all to do with Anglo-Saxon stuff. Who gets to say they're English and who doesn't? It's quite funny, this. David Lammy and Jean.
You keep saying that you are African Caribbean, which is fine. But how can you be African Caribbean and English? I couldn't be African. I'm English, but I certainly could not call myself African Caribbean.
You could be Irish, though. You could have Irish.
No, I'm not Irish.
Yeah, but
you
could be. You could be.
No, I'm not, because I have looked my name right the way back to the Middle Ages, my maiden name, and I'm Anglo-Saxon.
Great.
But you will never be English. You are African Caribbean.
But why will I never be English?
Because you're African Caribbean.
In a nutshell.
Look, I can't say to you.
At what point? What about my kids? What are my kids? What are my kids?
I can't say I'm African Caribbean.
What? Yeah, but the truth is, Jean, just a little bit of history on this. Britain, 400 years ago, started going out into the world. It colonised and conquered a lot of the world.
Mm.
A lot of the world has ended up coming back to the mother country. My parents were part of that generation who came from the Caribbean. Mm. When I took a DNA test, I actually had Scottish in me, probably because...
Why? He had some Scottish in him.
As a result of that, someone somewhere... frankly, got their leg over with one of my ancestors, and I've got Scottish blood.
Somebody somewhere got their leg over with one of his ancestors. It couldn't be one of his ancestors getting their leg over with the Scottish person, no.
Running through me. I said that gently, but it could have been horrendous. Let's be clear about that.
Oh, yeah, it might have been rape, yeah, for all we know.
And here I am, having grown up in this country, have been born of this country. And actually, the truth is, it's a myth that there's one English ethnicity. There's not, because England has always been a country in which Huguenots...
Huguenots,
Danes, all sorts of people have passed through. So when you say you are English, I'm not saying that that doesn't mean something to you and matter hugely.
It does.
Because there are probably, as you put it, years and years, hundreds of years of experience of that. But it is to say that for me, the fact that I was born here and the fact that my sensibilities are English mean that I want to claim that heritage as well.
Good man.
Very comfortable saying I'm British, black British. Of course I am. And I'm very, very proud. No one could say I wasn't, because I talk about it all the time, about my Caribbean roots. And
well,
I know the Caribbean very
British,
well. But it's
but
to say that
English.
I'm English. Sorry? What?
You're British, but you're not English.
He's British, but he's not English, says Jean.
English.
Well, that's the point I think you're making, and I'm disagreeing with that. Tell me, what do you think? What do you think?
I'm actually quite proud of David Lammy. I'll tell you why in a minute.
If I was born in the Caribbean as a white person, I certainly wouldn't call myself.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid.
Caribbean.
You obviously have you ever been to the Caribbean, Jean?
I haven't.
If Jean had been to the Caribbean, she'd be a Caribbean queen. He goes on to tell her that there are lots of white people in Barbados and they have been there for many, many years. It goes on.
And they are significantly more Caribbean than I am.
Well, all didn't I can know that, say did is you? The whole world is polluting everybody the way it's going.
What? The whole world is polluting everybody.
What's that phrase, polluting?
It is.
Why is it polluting, Jean?
Because you are what you are. But, you are where you are born.
But hang on, Jean.
Your
I don't,
inheritance.
Jean,
it's Jean, your inheritance.
Jean, I can tell that you are more senior than I am in age. So I want to be polite.
No, don't
in,
do that.
In
don't
this
do
conversation.
That.
Well, that,
don't patronise me, says Jean. Do not patronise me. I like this.
But that's how I was brought up, that you're polite to your seniors,
yeah,
Jean.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
What I'm...
should be polite to everybody, David.
I'm saying is, the word pollution...
Mm-hmm.
What, where's that word pollution come from? It's a very negative way...
But
it is negative. It's a negative way to describe the fact that people meet one another, they fall in love... They have kids, they move borders, sometimes through war, sometimes through economic reasons, and they become what they become when they are of that country.
Mm-hmm.
And just as you can be in America, and you can be African-American, or you can be Italian-American, or you can be Irish-American, how is it that here in England, you can only claim that Englishness effectively, Jean, if you are white?
Good man. I'll tell you what I liked about that. David Lammy gets a lot of stick, doesn't he? And terms like snowflake and cancel culture are thrown around David Lammy a lot because he seems to be regularly calling for people to be deplatformed for something they said that he doesn't like. But I liked the way he conducted that. It went on for a few more minutes. It's on LBC's website. Good stuff. Listen to people. Don't call them names. Don't gaslight them. Don't call them racist. Just have a conversation with them. Why do you think that, Gene? That's interesting. Yeah, listen, I happen to feel British. Doesn't matter. Good stuff. More of that sort of thing. And down with calling people racist and xenophobic because they see the world a bit differently. Well done, Gene. Well done, David Lammy. Yes, if this is the vein that the mainstream media is going to continue in, I might change my mind about politicians getting radio shows, but of course I won't, because it's still terrible. 22 minutes past five. Thanks for your tweets, by the way. Tarlock says, Gene is probably a little bit more vociferous about race behind closed doors. Maybe, but maybe not. How do you know? Hi to Debs, how you doing? Debs... A number of you have tweeted this advertisement for a national pharmacy. What would you call it? A national pharmacy chain, that's the one. A national pharmacy chain is advertising a product called Viralease, which is a nasal spray, which if you use it, it claims that it inactivates up to 99.9% of the virus that causes COVID-19. Now, I saw this just before coming on air, and I haven't had time to look into it. Is this the Israeli product, I wonder? Do you remember? I wrote about this on richieallen.co.uk. I wrote about this a few weeks ago, because an Israeli, oh God, what's it called now? Begins with an S. San... No Ties, is it? Is that the name of the program? The company? It might be. An Israeli firm has designed or has produced a nasal spray that claims to stop coronavirus. I'm wondering if this is the generic name now, Viralease. I'll have to look into that. But it's just become available in the UK. It claims to inactivate the virus up to 99.9%. And a number of you are saying, well, why do we need a vaccine then? But if you read the advertisement on the company's website, it says that it complements social distancing and mask wearing. Hi to Lula. How you doing, Lula? Richie, I don't get it. If the vaccine doesn't stop someone getting the virus or transmitting it, then why would it matter if we don't get the vaccine? Maybe I'm just stupid or missing something. I had a letter and two texts for mine. I'm waiting for the call from the GP. Nothing stupid about you, Lula. It's a question that we're all asking. But common sense, you see, has no bearing on the decisions being made by people in positions of authority in this country. Hi to Chris Clough, Caribbean Jean, that's the one. Hi to Kim Wilman, who says, for once I totally agree with Lammy on this. Alan in Liverpool is Roman originally. Hi to Poodle Tip, how you doing, Poodle Tip? And what time is it now? 25 minutes past five. Right, it's time to move on. Before I take a tune to enable me to get my first guest on the programme today, let me remind you, a bit later on, Dr. Tess Laurie will be on this programme. She's in Bath. She is a medical doctor and researcher. She runs the evidence-based medicine consultancy, EBMC, that's E-BMC, and she's very interested in ivermectin. Now, back in December of last year, she saw Dr. Pierre Corey asking the US Senate to allow doctors in the US to prescribe ivermectin to COVID patients, and she wants to see it prescribed for COVID patients in this country. Very interesting is Tess, and she'll be with me in hour two. Before that, Brian Sylvester will be live on the programme from Cheshire. You don't want to miss him. God, that was loud. My name is Richie Allen, by the way. I am the BBG. This is not the BBC. Welcome to Monday's programmes. Gorgeous in Salford, and I'm gorgeous in my mind. The world is full of fools. Lightning Seeds and Change on The Richie Allen Show saw them support Madness at the Arena in Manchester about 4 years ago. Christmas week was an amazing show. Oh, God, be with the days. Would you take the vaccine? Would you? No, obviously not, right? Obviously not. Speaking of that, Charlotte says, I've been putting off going to the doctors for an urgent checkup, but I've decided to do it ASAP before they roll out the vaccine to my age group. I know all the staff and I can't face the conversations. I would advise Charlotte and anybody else to be polite and firm. If you don't want something, if you don't fancy something and you don't have any intentions of taking something, say it once and say it one time only, politely. And if they persist, put your foot down and say, I've made my decision. I have no intention of taking it. Thank you. Please don't offer it to me again, because I'll be offended, is what I would do. I haven't been contacted. I'm quite surprised, really. Now, I know I'm healthy and I'm fit, but I am an asthmatic. And that's in my file. That's in my permanent record. And I thought by now a 46-year-old balding gammon, baldy more like it, would have been given the hook. Do you want your vaccine there, baldy? I haven't heard from them. I don't know what's happening. Maybe I'm known. Maybe I'm better known than I think. Maybe I don't ask him. Jesus. He'll just record it and put it on his radio show. Of course I will. Let's get my first guest on the programme. It's nice to be welcoming him back. So it is. He has served the people of Crewe for nearly five decades now, including two terms as a councillor on Cheshire East Council. Massive following on social media. Spoke out very strongly against lockdown last year and coercive methods to get people to go along with lockdown and to get people to go along with vaccines. He told me over email that he will be running in May for councillor again, presumably in Cheshire East. We'll ask him. Let's welcome back to the programme Brian Sylvester. Brian, welcome back. Councillor, how are you?
Hi, Richie. It's been a long time. 6 months.
I know. I can't believe it. I really can't. I enjoyed having you on, Brian. And I'd mentioned
it too. Yeah,
I meant you to come back before now, but you're here now. Thank heavens for that. So tell us, you're going to run in May. I shouldn't presume or assume anything, but I'm guessing it'll be an anti-lockdown platform, Brian.
Yeah, I'm standing in two by-elections in Crewe. I'm already a councillor for a parish council, so I'm standing now for the town council and the borough council in two by-elections. Certainly, I'm anti-lockdown. I've been anti-lockdown for about 10 months at least now, and the whole thing gets crazier by the day, doesn't it?
It does, and I wanted to ask you about the things that you're hearing from your parishioners and the people you know in Crewe. Julia Hartley Brewer, very vexed on talk radio this morning about the fact that she's had the vaccine and it doesn't seem to be changing very much. 30 million people in the country have had the vaccine. But if you believe The Telegraph and The Times today, they're going to roll back on allowing holidays in May. They're going to push that back to August. People are perplexed about that. The vaccine was supposed to, you know, release everybody from lockdown and get people back to some semblance of normality. I'm presuming that you're meeting a lot of people, Brian, who have had the vaccine. Do they share those frustrations that things are not moving quick enough?
Yeah, I think they certainly do. Obviously, there's a mix. Some people like myself and yourself won't be taking the vaccine, and others are queuing up to get it. Now, that's the way of the world at the moment. And the thing about these elections, which is interesting, because there's elections throughout mainland Britain on May the 6th, all sorts of different types of elections. And one of the things we're seeing in the opinion polls is that Boris seems to be getting a bounce, a positive bounce from the vaccinations.
He's getting... No, I haven't seen any opinion polls this week, but yeah, I remember last week opinion polls published by Sky and by one of the broadsheets did say that he seems to, he's doing well as the vaccine rollout progresses. He's getting a lot of credit for that. Does that surprise you?
Not in a way, because you've got this great divide now, sadly, in the UK of those who can see what is really going on and those who believe what the mainstream media and the politicians are telling them. And it is a great divide.
The reason I asked them, what it might have sounded like a stupid question, me asking you, are you surprised by the bounce? I asked that because if people are becoming increasingly frustrated, Brian, that getting the vaccine isn't leading seemingly to any... I know they're saying today that you can meet six people outside home, you can go and play football, you can go and play golf, but it's not enough for people. That's why I suppose I'm a bit surprised. I thought he might have taken a bit of a caning, you know, because of the slow nature of the easing of regulations.
No, I think that the vaccine is the key in terms of its popularity at the moment. But I forecast that we're going to head for another lockdown come the autumn. And I think that is the reason why we've seen the furlough and also all the various powers that they have through the House of Commons have been extended, not to June, but to October. And you got to ask yourself, why to October? If these lockdowns have been ended more or less in June, why extend it to October? And I can only imagine that they've got something planned for us.
No opposition whatsoever in Westminster, apart from the COVID recovery group, disgruntled backbench Tory MPs, startling that Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats just waved it through, basically, last week.
Yeah, the old Boris has got no opposition. We're literally in a single party state, really. There's no opposition. There's a few MPs, as you say, who come out, but they're irrelevant in terms of the 650 MPs. And so we're in a single party dictatorship, which is being run by Boris. And when you look at old Keir Starmer, he really is in a bad place because he is just kowtowing to Boris. He's not opposing. All he's doing is nitpicking and saying, well, I'd lock down harder and faster and all the rest of it. But he's doing nothing different to what Boris is doing. And we've seen the same this week. And Starmer is really down in the polls. And I've always said that Starmer, he's coming up to his first year in office now as the Labour leader. And I said from the word go that Starmer would not be the Labour leader in 2024. He will be thrown out. Because for one thing, I think he is the most boring politician we've ever had.
Yeah, I mean, it's much of a muchness for me in terms of politicians in Westminster, in terms of charisma and charm. I don't see too much of it, Brian, to be honest, wherever I look. But yeah, I've heard that. They're throwing names around already as to who might succeed him, if indeed he does, if he is for the chop in the short or even in the midterm. Councillor Brian Sylvester is our guest. Folks, BBG Richie on Twitter, do drop us a tweet. Brian, you were booted off Twitter. Am I right in saying that?
Well, I've been suspended. I've been suspended since January for telling the truth, would you believe? Well, you would believe it, wouldn't you?
So
I'm suspended. I'm not. My account is still there. I still live in hope that I might get back. But I had 55,000 followers on Twitter, which is remarkable. And they just stopped it overnight. That is not right. They should not have that power, should they?
Well, hang on a sec. It's even more disturbing when you think that you are weeks away from, as you said earlier on, two by-elections.
Yeah.
Your opponents will have access to Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
You won't.
It's totally unfair. I've got access to the Facebook, but it's totally unfair in terms of Twitter. And Twitter, really, try to have it both ways. They say that they're not a publisher and therefore they're not responsible for anything that goes on their site. But when I try and put something on about the truth, they act as a publisher and take me off.
And take you off. Do you remember the tweet in question? Was it to do with lockdown?
It was. I was just pointing out that the fact, and it is a simple fact, which I think we all need to keep reminding ourselves of, and it's this, and I put it out recently on Facebook. 99.96% of us have not died from COVID. Now, people say, well, where do you get that figure from? Well, it's quite simple. You just take the population of the world, 7.9 billion, you look and find out how many have actually died with COVID. And as you well know, these figures are really doubtful because the figures with COVID are very dubious. But even if you take that at face value, we're talking about 2.8 million deaths. And that works out. Just do the maths. And that works out at 99.96% of us have not died from COVID. So there is no need for a vaccination if you look at it logically.
Now, when you put a figure out like that, and it is true, of course, on the face of it, people like Boris Johnson would say, well, a lot more people would be dead if we didn't lock down. That's what they say. They're saying it today.
Yeah, well, that again, Richard, you know that's nonsense because the lockdowns have killed many, many times more than COVID. Many, many times. You just got to look at the people who are dying of cancer who could have been saved, people with heart attacks who could have been saved, the people who are committing suicide, sadly, the suicide figures have been drastically covered up, shamefully. And when those figures come out, people will be staggered. And when you look, and the sort of things which Boris has been responsible for, at the beginning of all this, he placed 25,000 elderly, untested, from the hospitals into the care homes.
That's right.
And the result was that many, many thousands of British elderly people died unnecessarily. It's a scandal.
Do we know? I don't have the figure to hand, but back in spring last year, when seniors were dying in care homes because of that catastrophic error, some people say it wasn't so much of an error, but I have no proof that it wasn't an error. But anyway, do we know how many people died at that stage? It was in the region of 30,000, was it?
Yeah, at the early stages, I think the majority of those who were dying were in care homes. It's slightly different now, perhaps, but you can't say they didn't know. Of course they knew. If you're going to put untested elderly people into care homes, then you're going to have big, big problems. One of the things is that what Boris has done is the exact opposite of what he should have done. He protected those who didn't need protecting, people like you and me and the young people. They didn't need protecting. And he failed to protect the elderly and the vulnerable.
Councillor Brian Sylvester is our guest, folks. At BBG Richie is the Twitter handle. Follow me there. You'll find Brian on Facebook. You'll find him very easily on Facebook if you do use Facebook there. You've been offered a vaccine, Brian, have you?
I have indeed.
And how did that go as a matter of interest? Because I hear from listeners quite regularly to say that it's a bit persistent in terms of, you know, they can be a bit pushy with it, or that sometimes they use terms like, oh, you'll go on the decline list, whatever that means. How did your offer go, and how did you deal with it?
Yeah, no, I had multiple offers, and I still get some offers now, but I politely rang up and said, no, I'm not having it, and there we are. But the vast majority are having it, certainly in the elderly.
Yeah, it seems that the take-up amongst over 75s has been, if you believe the government, that is, it's been, well, over 95%, they're saying, in the over 75s. What about proposals that we've been hearing? I mean, Nadeem Zahawi, the vaccine minister, and any number of cabinet members back in January said that vaccine passports were authoritarian or anti-British. But they're going to come in some form. I mean, in Israel, we know that they're using a green passport. They still can't get over it. Of all the places in the world, people must demonstrate that they've been vaccinated in order to get into hotels and gyms and stuff like that. How likely do you see this, Brian? How likely is this going? Will this come to pass, do you think?
Yes, sadly, I think it will. The vaccine passports will come to pass. They shouldn't do. In a free society, we shouldn't be going down that path. You mentioned Israel. There was a video only a few days ago that on the YouTube or wherever of a survivor of the Holocaust who was saying quite chillingly that this is worse than the Holocaust in terms of it's exactly the same as what happened back in Germany in the 1930s and 40s. And it really is chilling.
Yeah, I must check that out now. That's the sort of thing that people should be watching. When somebody has been through that and they're saying, listen, this is crazy, don't do it. It's important that people hear that, no doubt about it. One of the cinema chains, again, it escapes me. One of the UK cinema chains has proposed over the weekend that they have screenings for the vaccinated and screenings for the unvaccinated. What about some sort of dual societies coexisting side by side, Brian? Those who have the vaccine and those who don't. Maybe entrepreneurs around the country should be looking at the unvaccinated as a big, I don't know, as a big potential client base. What do you think of that?
Well, one of your frequent guests, Dolores Cahill, she's talked about the freedom flights, hasn't she? And,
yeah.
And having flights which you don't have to wear masks and be vaccinated, etc. I think that's a very good idea, Richie. I think that the entrepreneurs who are listening to this programme should be thinking about this, because there's going to be a clear market for people who will not be vaccinated but still want to go to the cinema, still want to see the football, still want to go to the pub. And that market needs to be met.
You said that you think once we get into autumn, we'll have more lockdowns. Now, just to qualify that, a number of epidemiologists, some of them advising the government, have said that they would expect waves of coronavirus variant strains of it in the autumn. And that might mean that in the autumn, in the winter, we might need to retain things like social distancing and mask wearing. So is it a case of just social distancing and mask wearing might be with us, or is it the full lockdown you think will be coming back, making a comeback this autumn, this winter?
Sadly, I think the lockdown will come back because otherwise, why have they extended the furlough to October? And the thing is about this PCR test, which again is another joke in this whole system. The PCR test is totally flawed, as we well know. And there's videos online from the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister where they clearly say on live on television that the PCR test for COVID is 93% false positive. Now, why on earth are they carrying on with that ridiculous test when it's clearly a failed test? But they can use that. The thing is, with that test, it depends on the number of cycles they have on the test. At the moment in the UK, it's around about 45 cycles, when it should be around 30. And so they can scale up the cycling of it to get the actual outcome they want. If they want to have more tests positive, they can do it. If you want less, they can do it. And I understand that if they did it to the cycle of 60, did it 60 cycles, then every test would be positive. It's a perfect test for the politicians because they can get whatever response that they want.
And a higher court in Portugal late last year issued a judgment on the test and said that it shouldn't be used to look for coronavirus, that it's not safe, it's not reliable. Councillor Brian Sylvester is our guest. Good to have him back on the programme. At BBG Richie is the Twitter handle. Do you ever think, Brian, I mean, before I ask you, I'm going to ask you about where we are and the dystopian nature of all of this. But look at Brisbane. Imagine being in Brisbane today. It's going to go into a snap lockdown tomorrow because they found 7 cases. 2 million people live in that city. They found 7 cases. And I have it on authority that none of the people they found COVID in were in any way symptomatic. And yet the Premier of Queensland, of the state, has said we're going to lock down everything again for 3 days. It's just insane, isn't it?
This is just crazy, crazy stuff. When you look at the number of deaths with COVID within the last 28 days. On Sunday in the UK, it was 19 out of a population of 66 million. And when you consider that each day in the UK, 1,700 die and 19 die from COVID, you've got to ask the question, why on earth are we still locked down? Why aren't we opened up today?
Scotland, sorry, Brian, Scotland has had no deaths according to health authorities there, for want of a better way of putting it, in 3 days. No new coronavirus related deaths. I mean, they don't say, they should say related, but they don't say related. They shouldn't even say related. I mean, deaths within 28 days of testing positive, but nothing. And again, nothing. But you know, Brian, can I just say this?
Yeah.
For me, I look at what they're, I listen to Johnson, I listen to Whitty and Valance and Susan Hopkins and all these people. And it's maddening listening to them, knowing that there are so many equally qualified men and women who disagree with them, but we don't hear. That's bad enough. But I tell you what really cheeses me off, and I've written about this extensively in recent days, ordinary people like me and you, that's what pisses me off, Brian. We've capitulated to it, society, just absolutely prostrated ourselves in front of the government. There's been little or no fight back. I mean, I don't know how people can stand by and see their businesses. And for many of these people, as you well know, businesses are like babies. You put your life, your heart and soul into them, and yet they've just given them up. Where's the opposition amongst the people?
Well, hopefully the opposition will grow. I know it's pretty gloomy at the moment, but we've got to try and stay positive. But if I'm right in my assumption that we're heading for another lockdown come the autumn, then, you know, all these businesses, the pubs and the shops, they'll be opening up again for a few months and they'll be closed down again. No business can carry on like that. And you wonder why. You wonder why if there is a bigger reason behind all this, because we're going to end up with thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of these businesses will never open again.
Never open again. You see, we've already lost thousands of pubs. Thousands have already gone out of business for good. This is a fact. I'm not making this up. And again, not to be negative, because I don't like being negative. But again, those businesses just meekly went out of business and put the gone out of business sign on the door and packed up their belongings. I don't understand it, Brian. I'm not a hard man, but I'm a fighter, me. You know, I'll stand up to bullies. There's no way that I wouldn't open my business. No way. Let them arrest me and drag me away. Let them humiliate themselves by doing that to a law-abiding bloke. I would open up and damn it. But so many of them have just gone out of business, packing up.
Well, they have. And the other sinister part is that the government has just introduced a law to make it more difficult to protest.
Yeah, and again, I was coming to this, right? So this is the contentious crime and policing bill.
Yes.
Which gives extraordinary powers to the police, whereby the police can tell you when you can. I know people will say they had those protests already, but they'll give you the start and end date. And they can also pick you up and arrest you, even if you didn't know that you weren't permitted to do this or to do that in this area. If you have a megaphone, you could be done for causing a nuisance. The tyrannical stuff, Brian.
It is, especially coming from a party who calls themselves a Conservative Party, and you would have thought believe in freedom, but they're taking all our freedoms away. It is scandalous, and there's no real opposition to it. So all we can do, there's votes coming up on May the 6th, as we've said, across the mainland Britain for all various people. And candidates. And I would certainly recommend to your listeners, do not vote for any party that is in Parliament at the moment, because they have all failed you. They have all failed you. And vote for independents and vote for alternative candidates, because that is the only way forward.
Brian Sylvester is our guest. It's exactly 9 minutes to 6 o'clock. We've got Brian for another couple of minutes. Lots of tweets on this. What do you make of what's been going on in Bristol? There are two stories emerging. You've got the police saying that we've got anarchist thugs, basically. But you've got people there who say, no, we're not anarchists, we're not thugs. We're exercising our God-given right to protest laws that we think are illiberal. Who's telling the truth, Brian? What's going on down there?
Well, it's difficult to know, but when I first saw it, my first thought was, is this a false flag? Because it's so played into the government's narrative that attacking the police, of course, we're all opposed to anybody attacking the police. But was it a setup? We don't know. But you begin to wonder.
They've been told, I understand, police forces around the country. Now, as a councillor, as a parish councillor as you are now, but you've been a Cheshire councillor in your time, and you might very well be again. You'll have had a lot to do with the police. You'll have had meetings with police and policemen and policewomen. We understand, don't we, that the Home Office has told police forces around the country to prepare for a summer of discontent. What do you think of that? Do you think we're going to see the escalation of protests around the country?
I think we're going to see more protests, and I, in a sense, I hope we do. But I would certainly call for them to be peaceful. But as you said earlier, we've got to express our view on this, and we've got to get out there and to try and change the views of those who are going along with this nonsense.
This morning, a number of government ministers, including what's his face, his name escapes me now. Huddleston, that's the guy, sports minister, that's the one, Nigel Huddleston, warning people about hugging. I mean, Brian, you're not much older than me. You're a little older than me. Do you ever, I mean, are you scratching your head? Can you believe? I sometimes really do. I believe it's a waking nightmare that this can't be happening. I couldn't really be watching breakfast television and watching a minister tell people to warn people not to hug them. What's going on?
No, this is madness, isn't it? And we need to get out there and be close to people and hug people. Yes, we should, because as I said before, that the risk has been so greatly exaggerated, and the government really, really are to blame here, because they've exaggerated it so much that some people are so scared of this COVID that they're even afraid to leave their homes. And it will take a lot for them to even get out of the house. And there's no need for that. When you look at the figures, there's no need for it.
Interesting you talk about people maybe hesitant to get back to, again, some semblance of normality. A number of commentators were hypothesising this morning about such a reality, saying that, yeah, a lot of people would be very nervous about coming out. Crazy stuff, this. I don't know, Brian. I don't know where we're going to be this time next year. I really don't. I think social crediting is going to be a big thing, Brian. You know, in terms of rewarding good citizens for good behaviour. They're talking today about giving young people the vaccine as a priority if they happen to live with somebody who's got a suppressed immune system. I mean, these are mad times. Again, I can't believe I'm reading this stuff. You know, young people who are not going to get sick from coronavirus, they're not going to get it, most of them. And even if they do, it'll be incredibly mild. And they're saying, listen, have a vaccine, be a good citizen, have a vaccine for those people who can't. Let me ask you this. Is Boris Johnson and his government, are they operating under duress? Has the government been hijacked by the scientific, I don't want to say community, but by scientists like Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance? Are they really running the show now?
Certainly, Boris is not in charge. He is a puppet. He's having his strings pulled. When you talk about children in school, for example, children in school are more likely to be hit by lightning than to die of COVID. And the teachers in school are more likely to die in a car crash driving to school than being killed by COVID. So when you look at, again, if you look at in the cold light of day at the figures, there's no justification for any of this. And the idea that we should be vaccinating healthy young kids, it just completely insane.
Do you ever have any doubts, Brian, at all? I mean, none of us are infallible. And I've asked this to friends of mine who would share your thoughts on what's been happening over the last 12 months and share my thoughts and feelings about it. Do you ever have any moments where you think, I wonder, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is more deadly than I'm giving it credit. Maybe it is. And, you know, I could be wrong. Has it ever crossed your mind?
No, because, again, you just got to look at the figures. You can't hide away from the actual figures. They can actually try and make out that more people have died of COVID than actually have. But when you look at the number of deaths in 2020, it wasn't a particularly bad year for in terms of the number of deaths in a year. So, yes, the number of deaths was up. But to no great extent. And so when you look at the figures clearly show that this lockdown is not required. It's not necessary. In fact, the lockdown has killed many, many more people than whatever the COVID will kill.
There's talks of an inquiry. Final question, Brian. He's been pressured from some quarters. I know his backbenchers, the likes of Steve Baker and others who are very much anti-lockdown, have been pressuring him for a fully independent inquiry into dealing with the pandemic from the very beginning. Do you think that's going to happen anytime soon?
I think that they will have to have an inquiry, obviously. But I've no hopes for the inquiry, because we've had these sort of inquiries in the past into the Iraq war and all the rest of it. And they come to nothing. They spend years looking into all the evidence and then come out with the conclusions that don't actually pin the blame on the people where the blame should lie. And the blame lies with Boris and Hancock and all the rest of them. They must know. That this is all nonsense and that they're carrying it out for reasons for which we're not being told.
Listen, good luck in 5 or 6 weeks' time, May 6th. People listening to this who are in Cheshire, where did they go online to find out about your campaign, Brian, and how they can help you out there?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. I'm standing in Crewe West, and if they go on Facebook, Councillor Brian Sylvester on Facebook, please contact me and that'd be great.
Shocking that you're banned on Twitter. I wonder, is there something could be done legally there, Brian? Because I followed your Twitter account . I know that there was nothing remotely wrong or improper about your tweets. The fact that they could do that could, and I hope it doesn't for your sake, but could seriously jeopardise your ability to get your message to potential voters there. Is there anything you can do about that?
Well, they don't seem to. Obviously, I've objected, I've appealed, but they don't seem to want to listen. But I am in good company. You know, President Trump had his suspended as well. But the power of these social media groups like Twitter need to be addressed.
Brian, thanks for coming back today. Councillor Brian Sylvester on Facebook. Good luck campaigning in the next few weeks. It's going to be interesting, whatever happens. It's a national, local elections. I wonder, will there be a big anti-lockdown vote around the country? I hope so anyway. Brian, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Richie.
Nice to speak to you again. Councillor Brian Sylvester, a parish councillor these days, but he has been a Crewe East councillor on a couple of occasions. He's been a public servant in Crewe, in Cheshire, I should say, for the best part of 5 decades. He's standing again in Crewe West this coming May 6th, local elections. You get what I'm saying. I was going to mention at the top of the programme, but I ran out of time. I have obviously noticed the coverage, the UK media coverage of the Derek Chauvin. Is that how you pronounce his name? Chauvin. I think it's Chauvin. He's gone on trial, hasn't he, this afternoon. He's the guy accused of kneeling on the neck. Well, he did kneel on the neck of George Floyd. We saw the videos there for 8 minutes or 9 minutes. And obviously George Floyd died. I know a lot of you don't believe. I get these tweets. I get these emails. And listen, I'm a proponent of free speech. I'm a supporter of it. So if you believe that the whole thing was staged, you're entitled to do that, and I wouldn't knock you for it, and I certainly can't prove a negative, so I can't say you're wrong. It's not how I see it, to be honest, right? I know that you think that the Black Lives Matter thing is another big divide and conquer agenda, and I have a lot of sympathy with that point of view, and we know there are various groups who fund and sponsor groups like Black Lives Matter. Again, I'm with you on that. I've talked about it a lot on the programme. But they don't need to fake these things, you know. They just need to wait for one to come along. And police brutality is not new. It's not a new thing. But found it fascinating today that BBC and Sky are giving blanket coverage to the trial. Blanket coverage. Sky News has set up an extra channel where the hearing will be covered live, blow by blow, basically minute by minute coverage of it. I don't know if the BBC is doing that, but as somebody who's worked in the media for over 20 years now, 23 years in fact, this year, it's telling, it's revelatory really in looking at the media and what the media does. There should be no interest in this country in that trial, none whatsoever. There's no reason why the UK 24-hour news channels would want to cover it. I don't mean cover it. I mean, you'd want to be mentioning it. You'd want to be mentioning it, like today in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the jury were told this or that. But to show it live, well, again, look, I've done a lot on this in the past. I won't get into it now. Here's music from Ozzy Osbourne. And I'll come back and read your tweets. And in a few minutes' time, Dr. Tess Lawry will be live on this programme from Bath. You don't want to miss her. Very, very interesting. We'll be talking about ivermectin. It's a drug, and apparently it's very, very good at treating people with respiratory illnesses. It's Monday's Richie Allen programme, the 29th of March 2021, with me, the BBG. Keep those tweets coming in at BBG Richie. As I said, I'll read them when we come back from this from Ozzy. Ozzy Osbourne, Crazy Train on the Richie Allen Radio Show. 6 minutes past 6:06 it is PM, on the old PM there. A good tweet there from Gaddafi. He says, Richie, the only thing I will say about the George Floyd death, the murder of George Floyd, is why did it get filmed for all those agonising minutes? Someone should have come out from behind their telephone and actually acted to intervene, to jump in a little, but nobody did. It's a really good point, and it's a point that was made last year when this happened. In fact, I made it myself. I'm not so surprised that people didn't intervene, really. I suppose you could make, and I'm only making an argument now. Like I said, I don't know anything, and I'm not dismissive of other people's point of view. I'm not, but I like to make arguments. I make the argument that maybe many of the people standing there didn't realise just how serious George Floyd's situation was. Maybe. Also factor in that a lot of people are intimidated by the police, particularly in certain parts of the United States of America. Police are pretty violent, right? Or can be pretty violent in dealing with people. So I don't know. When people send me messages say, oh, the whole thing was staged, Richie, I roll my eyes, because ordinarily, or at the best of times, they don't give you any evidence to support that. Just conjecture. And that's fair enough. Like I said, by all means, you know. I had people last year on this very programme tell me that they believed that it was staged in order to, you know, to let loose this movement and everything that followed. And I think, look, people who have agendas, they don't need to stage things. Police brutality, as I said earlier, isn't a new thing. It's not. It happens. You just have to wait around. You know, we see people being shot. We see people, unarmed people being shot dead by the police. Unarmed black people, unarmed white people. Police brutality isn't reserved exclusively for African Americans. You know, is what I would say. I tend to keep my powder dry. I don't know. But it is, as William said on Twitter a few moments ago, William in Scotland. Yeah, I mean, it's one big theatrical thing now. The court case being televised on British television by two 24-hour news channels is, well, it makes no sense. There is an agenda. But anyway, look, it's exactly 9 minutes past six. I'm looking forward to speaking with Dr. Tess Lawry. And I know many of you are interested in this, because last year we saw those videos of doctors in America, didn't we? In certain parts of the US, in Texas and elsewhere, saying that we have used ivermectin on patients, that we've used other, what was it, hydroxychloroquine, that's the one, we've used that on patients in our practices, in our surgeries, and we found it to be efficacious. We found it worked, and it worked well, but no take-up, media not interested. Look, let's get Tess Lawry on the programme. Now, very interesting lady is Tess, mentioned at the top of the programme that she is a medical doctor and researcher. She's based in Bath, which, if you've been to Bath and have one time, it's a beautiful part of the country. And Dr. Tess Lawry runs the evidence-based medicine consultancy there, which you can find it under E-BMC. And she's very interested in ivermectin, because she saw Dr. Pierre Corey asking the US Senate to allow doctors to prescribe the drug for use against COVID. She saw that back in December of last year, and she wants it to be considered for use here against COVID-19, and has launched a fundraiser to help with that. Now, if you go to GoFundMe and look for Help Us Get Life-Saving Drug Approved for COVID-19, You'll find all you need to know about it there. The fundraiser is entitled Help Us Get Life-Saving Drug Approved for COVID-19. Let's welcome to the programme Dr. Tess Lawrie. Tess, you're very welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, Richie. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks. And Bath, of course, as I mentioned in my introduction, is a beautiful part of the country. And I'm guessing, Tess, you're bathed in sunshine this evening and still you've come on the radio to talk to me. So thanks for doing that. I'm guessing it's glorious there today, right?
It's a stunning day and I'm looking out the window wishing I was there.
Well, we won't keep you too long, but we've got a lot of important things to talk about. Tell us about ivermectin and you watching Pierre Corey back in December seemed to have motivated you. Tell us about it.
Yes, well, part of what I do is called evidence synthesis. And this is evaluation of the medical literature on any intervention or treatment to see whether it's effective and safe. And I do this routinely for the people that hire me, including the World Health Organization. So when I saw Pierre Corey's testimony in front of the US State Senate in December, I was quite curious because I'd never really seen a doctor begging for a treatment, to be used. And usually I've always thought doctors can prescribe things that they, medicines that they feel will be useful to their patients. And so I thought, well, this is something I could do. I could look at the evidence. And then if it is useful as Dr. Corey was saying, I could alert the World Health Organization or at least share my findings. And also with the health department in the UK, and then I could get back to my work, because it was during Christmas and New Year that I obtained all the studies on ivermectin, and I evaluated it the way I usually evaluate evidence, and by the end of the week I was quite sure that ivermectin is effective for treating and preventing COVID. And so I put a report together and I sent it to the health department, the World Health Organization, and some members of parliament and anybody that I thought could be, would be interested. Then unfortunately I didn't have a response.
Wow.
After a few days, I put a video appeal, rather out of character, on YouTube to the Prime Minister to say, I've got this evidence. This is what I do. I've got this evidence. Please, can you contact me or get somebody from the health department to contact me? Because I have sent emails and they've got my details. And then I still didn't get a response, but I got quite a response from health professionals and also members of the public, wanting to know more and asking, how they could help or how I could disseminate the information further. But as a behind-the-scenes person, I didn't really have, not terribly well connected in the way, certainly in terms of, hotlines to the health department and so on. So I decided to do what I usually do for the World Health Organization, and that is to do a comprehensive systematic review with experienced colleagues, and then present the evidence in what's called an evidence to decision framework. Now, all this means is really it's a document that has different headings, and it's got a heading for the evidence on the effects, the benefits and harms of an intervention, and then it's got another heading on how much it costs and cost effectiveness. It's got a heading on whether people find it acceptable and whether it's a feasible intervention, and also on health equity, which is basically, how fair is the intervention, can poor people access it too, vulnerable populations, and so on. We did a systematic review. I put together a strong team of reviewers. We started from scratch, and we only included the highest quality of evidence, which is randomized controlled trials. And we were quite surprised. We found 21 randomized controlled trials. Most of these trials were done in low and middle income countries, and they were done by doctors who were working in the field. In fact, one thing you need to realize is that ivermectin is widely used throughout the world for parasitic infections. So it's been around for about 40 years, and about more than 3 billion doses have been given. And so it's a very well-known medicine, especially in tropical climates. And although it is used for scabies in Germany and America, in Europe and America, and it's on the World Health Organization's essential medicines list. It's very useful medicine. And in 2015, its developers got the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
So.
I saw the acclaim that it has received in recent years. I'm all ears. I'm gripped here, and so are our listeners. Please carry on, Tess. This is fascinating stuff. We're talking about ivermectin, by the way, with Dr. Tess Lawrie. Tess is in Bath at the moment, and as you've heard her say, she's a medical doctor and a researcher who runs the evidence-based medicine consultancy E-BMC. She's been in the past and recently, she looks into the efficacy of drugs for groups like the World Health Organization, and she's looking into and has been looking into ivermectin and how effective that might be against coronavirus 19. Tess, yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. So yeah, so I put together this document in a hurry because I was just aware that people were dying unnecessarily every day, and that ivermectin may really make a big difference. And so I felt this moral obligation to keep working on this project, even though. I wasn't getting paid for it or anything, and I had other work that needed to be done. But I just thought if I could just, communicate the message, then I could get back to my usual work.
Go back to work, yeah. Yeah.
And so I put this document together with the evidence, very comprehensive evidence, including country case studies of, because there are countries that are already using ivermectin and they're experiencing huge drops in their death rates and much lower death rates than what we're experiencing.
Who's using it, Tess? Do you mind me asking? Who's using it at the moment and having such success?
Well, the first country to document using it, and for which we have good evidence of its effect, is Peru. They started using it in May last year, and after using it, their deaths dropped off dramatically. I think they went from something like 350 a day to 50 a day, and then and interestingly, in November they had a change of president. And the new president restricted use of ivermectin, and their deaths went up again to 300 a day or something by January. So, and that's been clearly documented and is reported in the scientific literature. And then there's Uttar Pradesh. Uttar Pradesh in India is a state of more than 210 million people, and they introduced ivermectin in August last year. And in fact, the government set up these kiosks in town, I think, in the towns, and people would just go and collect the ivermectin. It was these little packs of ivermectin and doxycycline and zinc, and they distributed it that way. And they've had days where they've had virtually no COVID deaths at all. And they have a population 20 times that of the UK.
Wow. And you've put all of this together. And at the outset of our conversation today, Tess, you said that you sent this to the World Health Organization and you sent it to Whitehall. You sent it to the UK government. And to date, you've had no reply from them.
No, not at all. We've sent it to Wales government. We've sent it to Ireland, Northern Ireland. We've sent it to Scotland. We've sent it to Canada. We've sent it to the NIH in the States and the FDA, South Africa. We've sent it to many because we've actually had many because I put together this meeting, which we call the British Ivermectin Recommendation Development Meeting, or BIRD meeting. And it was like a mini World Health Organization meeting, actually. We ended up having representatives from 16 different countries around the world. And in the UK, doctors are not that aware or familiar with ivermectin. We had a lot of UK doctors, GPs, who were hearing about ivermectin for the first time and its use for COVID. And at the end of that meeting, we conducted it much like one would conduct a WHO meeting to make a recommendation with a panel of stakeholders. And the people who attended, there were about 65 people, they made judgments after each of the parcels of information, evidence was shared. And then at the end of the meeting, we agreed, well, they agreed. So I didn't vote on it. None of the people who were involved in the meeting preparation itself voted. It was just the panel of stakeholders that voted.
All transparent then. That's very transparent. I like that, right? So you didn't get to vote on it. And no. They loved it, presumably.
Yes, so they voted that ivermectin should be recommended for both prevention and treatment for COVID to reduce mortality and morbidity. And the outcome of that meeting was that, you know, they mandated me and the steering group to disseminate the information. So we set about then with that document, as I mentioned, sharing it. And also, we've also been having meetings with groups of doctors and other stakeholders. And certainly I've been involved in expert discussions organized by Pierre Corey's group, the Frontline Critical Care Alliance in the States, to try and share the information as widely as possible.
This is fascinating stuff, Tess. That's an understatement in the extreme. Evidence-based medicine consultancy, E-BMC, Dr. Tess Laurie runs that. I've been doing my own background checks into it ahead of speaking with Tess, as she said herself. She is a vastly experienced, by the way, and very, very respected medical doctor and researcher. And she believes the evidence exists that ivermectin is hugely efficacious for treating COVID-19 patients. No interest as of yet from governments in this country, Wales, you said, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Canada. What about the media, Tess? I mean, you're here now talking to an independent media programme with a big listenership, but still it's not the BBC, it's where you should be. What has the media done with the information you've given them?
It's been very difficult to get media interest in the ivermectin story. David Rose from the Daily Mail attended the Bird meeting, and he wrote an article, and he subsequently also was interviewed by Anna Breeze on YouTube, where he said it had been very difficult to get information on ivermectin published, and even the article that he wrote was cut down quite significantly, and there was some, ivermectin is a very cheap treatment. In some countries, it costs, a few cents a tablet, and you don't need a lot of it. So it's a generic medicine, and any manufacturer can make it.
So it's cheap. It's cheap, Tess. What about ivermectin side effects? What have you found?
Doctors who prescribe it say that, there are mild side effects similar to other sorts of medicines, like maybe dizziness or nausea, but they're not substantial. And if you look at the VigiAccess database, which is a pharmacovigilance database set up by the World Health Organization and Uppsala University in Sweden, and now you can enter any drug into that database and it'll come up with the number of registered adverse events against that drug and the number of registered deaths. Ivermectin's it's on that database since 1992. And since 1992, there's been 4,500 or so adverse events registered against ivermectin, despite there being billions of doses having been administered. I mean, just to put that in perspective, if you take something like remdesivir that's only been around for a year, remdesivir's got more adverse events registered in just this period compared to, 30 years of ivermectin registrations. and ivermectin's got 16 deaths associated potentially with it, whereas remdesivir has got 470. So, you know, it just, and also not nearly the number of doses, just a fraction of the doses that have ever been administered. So, you know, you can just, you can see that it's a very, very safe medicine. And in many countries, it's available over the counter, and people are self-administering, you know, for COVID, for worms.
When they have those symptoms. Right. Yes. I'm obviously going to ask you about the fundraiser and why you need to do that and what you need the money for. We'll come to that. I'm going to keep reminding our listeners who they are listening to. Dr. Tess Lawrie is an experienced and very well-respected researcher. She's a medical doctor, looks into medicines, right? The evidence-based medicine consultancy. Is the medicine effective? Is it safe? An expert, and has worked for the World Health Organization doing that very thing. She believes that ivermectin is a cost-effective, obviously, and very, very good treatment for coronavirus 19, but finding it difficult to get governments to pay attention to this and also to the media. Now, we're in the realms of speculation, Dr. Tess. Why? Why are you struggling to get the governments to listen? And why is the media so reticent to cover this obviously very important story? What is your suspicion?
Well, I think the media are worried about misinformation, perhaps. You know, there has, you know, there have been, there's a lot of, there's a lot of propaganda against ivermectin that I believe is being generated by those who stand to profit from the, you know, the novel medicines that are being developed. And so ivermectin kind of puts a bit of a spanner in the works in terms of things, because it's so cheap and it's safe and it's effective.
So lobbying, Tess, you think that those who run some of the pharmaceutical companies that are pushing other treatments might be lobbying those in power to take a dim view of ivermectin? I mean, it wouldn't be the first time. I mean, it's how politics works, right?
It might be, because, you know, it's if it wasn't tragic, it would be amusing just how, you know, how terrible the information is that comes out on ivermectin. I mean, even the BBC broadcasted something the other day, you know, suggesting that, you know, ivermectin is no good, and it's or it's you know, there isn't enough evidence on it, and more evidence is needed, and and it's simply just not true. And you know, and even for example, the Food and Drug Administration in the States, you know, they seem to emphasize that it's a veterinary medicine, which yes, it is a very useful veterinary medicine, but it's a very useful medicine in humans as well. I mean, it literally won the Nobel Prize for being in medicine, for being of immeasurable use to humanity in 2015. So, and its use continues to be expanded because it has, we now know it has antiviral properties as well as antiparasitic properties.
Can I just say, Tess, can I just say, with Tess coming on the program, I spent most of the afternoon looking into these claims, and I can't challenge Dr. Tess Lawrie or criticise what she's saying, because I found through my, I spent 3 hours on this afternoon, and Tess is telling the truth, right? So that's why I'm not challenging it. You believe that the BBC knows better. I don't want to be bashing the BBC. It gets a lot of bashing on independent programmes like this. But you believe it knows better than that which it is broadcasting, that it knows that ivermectin is effective, but it puts out information to the contrary.
No, I'm not sure what
you
it knows.
Know.
All I know is that that they're certainly not looking at the highest level of evidence. None of these bodies are. And the highest level of evidence is the evidence that we have provided.
Right.
And so, you know, there was, for example, a study published in JAMA, a Colombian study. JAMA is a very prestigious medical journal. And that was published about 2 weeks ago. And all the authorities around the world seem to jump on this study and say, "Oh, you see, it doesn't work. It was a negative study." So, it was a study conducted in mild disease among about 400 people, and And it was a so-called double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial, which is supposed to be a high quality trial, but there were numerous limitations and flaws in the study design, not least of all the fact that those who were meant to get the placebo, a number of them received ivermectin instead. So it's certainly not a great study that should be heralded over the level of evidence that we have, because what a systematic review does is it evaluates all studies, all randomized controlled trials on a subject, and then we pool the data. So we assess each study for its risk of bias and its quality, and then we pool those data and to come up with an overall estimate of the effect. So there's no point in so it's a much higher level of evidence than a single study, and yeah. It doesn't matter whether the study is positive or negative. You will always get a range of outcomes, which is why, you know, the role of a systematic reviewer and the work that I do is so important.
It is important, Tess. I've got to ask this. Do you have any connection to any company that manufactures ivermectin? Have you got anything to gain yourself if this drug was to be approved in the UK? I know the answer, but I've got to ask it.
No, but I would find it very rewarding to be able to save as many lives as possible. So I have nothing to gain financially, but I have a lot to gain as a doctor.
As a doctor. Now, I've interviewed in recent weeks some renowned epidemiologists and virologists who can't, sadly, get to get an interview on national TV or radio in this country. I could name them, Kulldorff, Harvard, I've had them all on. Sacharit Bhakti from Germany and people like that, they can't get on. So I want to ask you a couple of questions. You don't have to answer any of these. They'll just be quick fire questions in a moment. Nothing too crazy. But before I do that, just a very quick word on hydroxychloroquine. I mention that because, a respected GP without a blot on his copybook, Dr. Pat Morrissey in Adair in Ireland, in my country, of course. Pat's come under enormous pressure from the authorities there not to prescribe hydroxychloroquine. He's come on this programme and he said, listen, I'm a doctor. I operate, I work on my conscience. I found it to be very useful in people that have coronavirus, so I have prescribed it, but they're coming down very hard on me not to do that. As quick as you can, if you don't mind, Tess, what do you know about it? Is that something that you might look into in the future, hydroxychloroquine?
Yes. So there's a lot of certainly a lot of doctors who believe in hydroxychloroquine, and I think it would certainly be within the range of possibilities for us to undertake a systematic review of hydroxychloroquine in the not too distant future.
Brilliant. Good answer. Now I've got to ask you this. I'm certainly no COVID denier, Tess. I was very ill last January. It might very well have been COVID-19. I don't know. I'm happy enough that COVID is real and that it's problematic and that vulnerable people are vulnerable to it. But I've had people on. I've mentioned some of these luminaries as they would be considered on this program. They're concerned, not so much they're certainly not COVID deniers, but they're worried about the testing for coronavirus, the PCR test, not being the best thing in the world, not being the most reliable test in the world. And they worry about listing people who've died within 28 days of testing positive for coronavirus. This is one of these quickfire questions. Is that something that would ordinarily concern you, that we might be adding people to the death list that maybe shouldn't be? Is that a possibility?
I think it is a possibility. I mean, this isn't my area of expertise, but I did look at, in December, I looked at some of the data on deaths, particularly I was looking at deaths in Scotland, because the nice thing about the Scottish data is that they report their data according to where they occur, so whether they occur at home, whether they occur in hospital, whether they occur in care homes. It's quite interesting to see, how in the data that I looked at, the deaths at home had obviously gone up significantly, and there were, you know, deaths for respiratory illnesses were down, deaths for COVID were up. So there would sort of been a shifting around of data to a degree, but
you've answered that, Tess. Like I said, I've had qualified men and women on this program. They're concerned. They think the death numbers have been inflated by the nature of how they're counting them. So that's fair enough. I have no idea. Obviously, as a lay person, but I'm very interested in that if that were the case. And I've got to ask you, while you're on, what is your personal opinion of using lockdowns to try and suppress illness? Again, you won't be surprised. The great Barrington doctors who've come on this programme, none of them are in favour of lockdowns. What's your own opinion on that, Tess?
I think the harms of lockdown are probably worse than, I think basically, and there are countries that are using ivermectin, and if you use ivermectin, there's no need for lockdown at all. It reduces the transmission, and it reduces your chances of infecting anybody else. It reduces the length of time that you're sick. It'll reduce the hospital admissions. And I think life can just get back to normal.
Good stuff. And the final of these questions, before we talk about your fundraiser and what you hope to achieve with it, before I ask you the final of these not dodgy questions, but questions I just have to ask because of my own curiosity. You are listening to Dr. Tess Lawry in beautiful Bath, where the sun is splitting the rocks. I can feel you looking over your shoulder out the window there. We won't keep you too much longer to get out in the sun while it lasts. We've got it tomorrow and Wednesday as well, I believe. Tess is a medical doctor and a respected researcher running the evidence-based medicine consultancy. If you look up E-BMC, you'll find out all you need to know about it. She's been employed by the World Health Organization to look into medicines in the past. She believes that ivermectin is proving to be very effective against coronavirus 19, and she is stumped, I suppose, as to why governments, including this one, don't want to know about it and why the media doesn't want to talk about it either. All right, Tess, here's the nasty question. Now, you're not talking to an anti-vaxxer, by the way. You're not. But everybody who asks questions these days tends to be labelled anti-vaxxer. So again, this is just a theory question, really, an opinion question. A lot of people are concerned that it normally takes a long time for a vaccine to get approved and to get given to doctors and nurses to put into people's arms. This new type of treatment, mRNA technology, maybe I shouldn't say technology, but it's very new and people are concerned about it. Now, Tess, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I'm 46 years old and I'm very healthy. I will be declining it, not because I'm an anti-vaxxer. And I don't believe that Bill Gates is getting these things and putting microchips in them before they go to the doctor's surgeries either. I don't believe that either. But I'm concerned about it, Tess, and I don't believe that they know for sure that these things are safe. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm not an anti-vaxxer either. I'm fully vaccinated and my children are too. I have been monitoring the adverse events of the vaccines on the Vigiaxis database. And I am concerned that we are seeing an increase in quite significant adverse events and also some deaths reported on the Vigiaxis database. I think as of today, it's something like 350,000 adverse events and 2,700 deaths. We also receive a number of emails from members of the public and health professionals, expressing concerns. So I feel that this is something that needs to be systematically reviewed and is something that as a team we can undertake in the next few weeks, hopefully.
Brilliant, Tess. I'm glad to hear that. I was going to ask that. Would you be looking into the vaccines? And probably a bit cheeky, but based on what you've said, would you be hesitant yourself about taking it at the moment anyway?
Well, yes, I would.
Fair enough. Yeah, I'm pushing you there. Dr. Tess Lawry is our guest. Listen, the GoFundMe fundraiser is entitled Help Us Get Life-Saving Drug Approved for COVID-19. Just before we talk about that, me talking about Gates and some of the silly stories about microchips and all that, I'm not entirely thrilled, to be honest, about Gates and his funding of universities, not just in this country, but all around the world, and the revolving door and all of that. But that's for another day, because I'm getting dogs abuse now for some of my listeners for seemingly giving Gates a pass. But look, tell us about the fundraiser. And I know you're looking to raise £100,000. What will that be used for, Tess?
Yes. Well, firstly, Richie, what I've realised, you know, through this process is usually all my work is commissioned. So I never advertise for work, but I'm always busy and all my work has been commissioned. So it's other people's research or other organizations' research. And what this process has highlighted to me is the massive need for an independent research consultancy like mine to evaluate interventions or things of public concern and health and safety. And perhaps increase scientific accountability, in our governing bodies. So my intention is to, and what I've started the process is to change my company, or to start a new company called the Evidence-Based Medicine Company. It's a community interest company. It's called EBMC Squared. And this is the company into which the crowdfunding donations will go. And it will be completely transparent. The books will be open to the public, and it will be clear, you know, how their money is spent. My aim is to, obviously, we need to expand our team, because at the moment we've got 2.5 of our staff working full-time on ivermectin and dissemination, public awareness, responding to emails, so on. There are some studies that we are busy writing protocols for. One is for a study looking at ivermectin for long COVID, which I think is very important, because there are no treatments for long COVID at the moment that are known to work. And there is some evidence showing that ivermectin may help people with long COVID. So this is something we're urgently trying to get off the ground. As well as doing other systematic reviews, like I mentioned. But basically, I need, going forward, I see a body of work that's COVID related and that will be of interest to the public. And I need more staff the funds for that.
The funds, because it's not cheap. I understand that. That's GoFundMe. It's called, again, Help Us Get Life-Saving Drug Approved for COVID-19. A couple of things that I've noticed, again, and I have no skill here, Tess. I have no qualifications. Dr. Tess Lawrie is our guest today. But I was kind of stunned to read last month or the month before that flu seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth. And when this was announced, it was claimed, and it has been claimed, the reason for this is because of social distancing and mask wearing. I don't believe that, Tess. And again, I don't say that as any expert. You know, I could be blown out of the water here. But if it's so good for flu and it has effectively made flu disappear, I mean, even doctors on the Irish Health Service executive saying we have no flu this season. Surely it would have worked for coronavirus as well, or am I overstretching there?
I think most respiratory illnesses these days do somehow get classified as COVID.
Is that right?
I think it's worth looking at those figures as well. If I had more staff,
you have enough to do, Tess. You have enough to do without looking into that as well. Yeah. But I worry about it. Yeah,
so much. You know, there's so much that needs to be done. So much that needs to be looked at independently. So it's case in point, really. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and it needs to be done quite urgently.
I worry about long COVID. Now, you're a medical expert, so I'm not going to criticise or challenge you at all. But a doctor friend of mine in Ireland said to me that some of the things they attribute to long COVID are kind of kind of lingering things that people who might have had the flu or might have had pneumonia would have anyway, you know, the weakness in the legs, the fatigue, the lack of sleep, that sort of thing. And I wonder, and I am going to put a conspiracy theory hat on me now, Tess, although you can completely disassociate yourself from me, as no doubt you will in my remarks. But again, they seem to be desperate to get us to have a vaccine. And again, I've got to say this, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I'm not saying that because I'm in any way being defensive. I'm not. But I look at the statistics around coronavirus and who it kills and who are really vulnerable from it. And I'm not. And I see a lot of pressure being brought to bear on me and people like me to have a vaccine that we might not or maybe don't need to have. And I wonder about these claims around long COVID and how legitimate they are, that maybe it's post-viral stuff that we've seen before. But again, I've got to qualify my remarks by saying I haven't got a Scooby-Doo about any of this stuff because I'm a journalist, not a physician. But what about my theory, Dr. Tess, that, you know, this might be designed, some of this stuff might be designed to get us to just kind of roll our sleeves up and have the vax. What do you think?
Oh, of course, there's a lot of stuff in there. I think long COVID is definitely very real. If you speak to people who have it, it's a very debilitating, very debilitating symptoms. And we do need to be using effective treatments to help people, which is why I want to do the ivermectin for long COVID study as soon as possible.
Yeah.
In terms of vaccines, you know, I think, you know, people have a choice with interventions, and I think people should remember that you do have a choice, and you shouldn't feel forced to take something if you're not quite ready to do so.
Fair play to you, Tess, because a lot of my listeners are concerned about, you know, being excluded from, I don't know, from a social life if they don't have it. And they're looking into vaccine passports. I can't believe in Israel, of all countries, you know, when you think of the history of Jewish people, that they've kind of gone along with that. I'm concerned about that. I have no intentions of having it, but I certainly wouldn't tell anybody else what to do. And I'd be concerned about, you know, what I might be excluded from. And you don't agree with that. You don't think it's right to do that.
No, I don't. No, you know, Rishi, the one thing we haven't discussed is why it's so difficult to communicate the message about ivermectin.
Yeah.
You know, I think, and there are a number of people who have suggested, that you know, the emergency use authorizations for novel treatments have been granted on the basis that there isn't an effective treatment for COVID.
That's right.
Ivermectin potentially stands in the way of that, because if ivermectin is approved because it's effective, potentially, you know, would mean that a lot of medicines that are being rapidly rolled out and given this emergency use authorization would have to go through the usual regulatory process, which would involve, you know, longer term evaluation.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is my concern, is that it's not a simple matter of seeing that it's effective and safe and should be used, that there's, you know, there's this other confounder, which is not, it's not insurmountable. I don't see why the governments can't perhaps change the legislation around emergency use authorization, or, you know, to accommodate both the use of ivermectin and the novel treatments. But I feel that is probably the sticking point at the moment. But I do think that if ivermectin were to be used for both, early on in the disease, we would just not be in the situation we are now, and we could get things back to normal.
Imagine that. I mean, that must be incredibly frustrating for you, Tess.
It is. You know, I had, when I first started out in the end of December, I just had many sleepless nights just thinking, how can I communicate this? And now I've just had to accept that it's a slow process, and it's just trying to communicate the message to the public, to health professionals, and it's you know, one just has to keep going.
I think you're doing I think it's brilliant. I'm so glad you came on. I suppose it's not so much of a question. I've been a journalist for over 20 years. It worries me when companies are indemnified by governments for products. It's not right that, you know, if a product is good enough and you believe it's good enough and you believe it's safe enough, and if you've done the proper studies and trials, well, you should be liable for anything that goes wrong with it. And our governments shouldn't be indemnifying these companies. But that's a personal opinion. Have you anything to say on that, Tess?
Well, I agree with you. Yeah, I think companies should be accountable for their products.
Folks, go to GoFundMe and look for Help Us Get Life-Saving Drug Approved for COVID-19. Dr. Tess Lawry has been speaking to us this hour about her belief that the evidence is overwhelming that ivermectin is safe and it's very effective on COVID-19. And you heard Tess describe there. I challenged her about the reality of long COVID, but she said that I'm wrong. She's convinced it's genuine. And she says that she believes it's effective on long COVID as well. Tess, I hope they start listening. I don't know how you'll achieve that. I mean, you do know the media has taken a real nasty turn against the Great Barrington Declaration doctors. And that stuns me, because these are men and women who've gone, like yourself, to the great universities. They've gotten their qualifications. And like you, they don't have any stake in it. They're just giving their honest to God opinion. So I wish you all the best in the world with the BBC and with the governments, that they'll listen to you, because you deserve to be listened to. You've got the credentials. Your company has proven in the past to be very successful at evaluating medicines for safety and for efficacy. You should be listened to, Tess. So I'll give you the final word and I'll shut up and say thanks for coming on. Final word to you, Tess, and then you can go out and enjoy the sun in gorgeous Bath.
Thanks, Richie. Well, I'd just like to say to people, if you know, there are resources on our website. There's the evidence base. You can download, you can share it with your GPs, your MPs, and there's also some templates of letters that you can share. You can write to help us get ivermectin approved as soon as possible.
Lovely to have you on, Tess. Thanks for making time for us this afternoon. It's hugely important that more and more people hear this. I know some of the YouTube videos have gotten hundreds of thousands of views. This is a popular programme. The podcast of this will be heard by at least 100,000 people. That'll be overnight tonight as well. Podomatic.com to find it. It goes on to iTunes and Spotify. But do go to the website. I'll put the link on the podcast to the website, and check out what you've been hearing there from Dr. Tess Lawry. Thanks for your time, Tess. Really appreciate
it. Thanks very much for listening to me.
Not at all. It was a pleasure, and all the very best for now. That was Dr. Tess Lawry in Bath. She heads up the evidence-based medicine consultancy. It's a private company called it's known as E-BMC. It's been looking into ivermectin for coronavirus 19, and it was fascinating speaking with her. I know some of you, like me, you're dubious about long COVID. I know this, I'm well aware of it. But fascinating. She said that she believes that some respiratory infections are being labelled as coronavirus when they're not, and that might explain the disappearance of flu in this country. She made it clear that she believes that lockdown does far more damage to people than people's lives that it might save. She couldn't be any more candid about that. And she believes, or at least she suspects, that the companies behind the experimental mRNA drugs, treatments, because that's what they are, those companies, lobbying maybe explains why the government here, the governments of Scotland and Wales, the government, of course, in Canada and elsewhere, might be reluctant to pay any attention to ivermectin. She was very candid about all of that. So, yeah. And you sent in lots of tweets as well, and I'm not going to have all the time in the world now to read all of them out. But thanks for them. David says, Richie, don't forget Chris Whitty's research background in malaria. Thanks, David. This is David Stone. Whitty understands ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. He knows they work, and he's responsible for every death those medicines could have prevented. Excuse me, alleges David. Thank you, David. for your opinion. I appreciate that. I don't know what Chris Whitty does or doesn't know. I can speculate like everybody else. I don't know. And listen, and you know, I have no time for Bill Gates. I'm getting hammered over the comment that I made about microchips and vaccines. But I stand by it. No time for Bill Gates. No program has done more to expose Bill Gates and what Bill Gates is doing and why he's behind this agenda to vaccinate the planet. But there's been some crazy stuff said, and I think it's been put out there to discredit the genuine information that is out there about Bill Gates, the things that you can prove about Gates and his funding of Ivy League universities all over the world, and how he uses that, how he uses Gavi, how he uses CEPI, C-E-P-I, how he uses the World Health Organization to push this vaccination agenda. Because he's behind that agenda to vaccinate people for everything. Things we don't need vaccines for. Right? Okay. I'm down with that, as you well know, if you've listened to this programme for long enough. Nearly out of time then. Thanks to Brian Sylvester for coming on the programme. And good luck to Brian, of course. Looking ahead to May 6th, the local elections in this country. All the best to Brian. We might hear from him before then, we might not. Thanks again to Dr. Tess Lawrie in Bath for her time today. Tragically, not speaking to BBC Radio 4 or BBC Radio 5 or BBC Breakfast, as she should be with her experience and her education and her qualifications. But there you go. I suppose that's why we have the independent media, I suppose. Right, I'll be back with you tomorrow at 5 o'clock UK time with Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. That's been Mondays. It's still bright and sunny and sparkly out there because we're now on British summertime. Isn't it lovely, isn't it? Isn't it? We've got good weather for the next couple of days. Apparently then, at the weekend, it gets bloody miserable again. But we'll make hay while the sun shines and all the rest of it there. Have a lovely Monday evening or Tuesday morning, depending on where you are in the world. It's bye from the BBG. Bye now.